Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Listen in as we discuss all things business, growth and marketing with business owners, thought leaders and entrepreneurs. And now, here's your host, founder of Roundhouse, the creative agency, Saul Edmonds.
Oh, hi everyone and welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Today I'm speaking with Corinne Murray. Corinne, how are you going today?
I'm doing well. Great to see you.
Yeah, likewise. Tell everyone where you are as well.
I am based in the world. In Brooklyn. Yeah, I'm based in Brooklyn, New York. And we were just saying we are approaching our summer months as you guys are going into your wintry ones.
Yes, yes. And you obviously, I mean, most people probably have some idea, probably from media more than anything, about New York, that that it sort of snows in New York in winter, really, doesn't it? Like, it gets pretty cold.
It does. This particular year, it was a very, very mild winter, which makes a lot of us scared for just how intense this summer might be. But we'll find out. Stay tuned, I guess.
Yeah. Likewise. I mean, I always find it really funny and curious how weather people can predict the weather. I get it. You know, I get that there's obviously science around how they do that, but still there's it always kind of puzzles me as to sometimes how accurate it ends up being. It's like, how can you, but then it's also just as random as well.
Yeah. It's definitely this like balancing of macro, like, you know, macro trends with like micro occurrences. And I think, you know, the micro occurrences are always the hardest to identify and, you know, predict. Whereas like the macro, if you step far enough back, you can kind of see just how the tides change.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that very point might actually be something you're saying, that is, would I be right in saying that some of those, that very idea of micro and macro trends applies to what we might be talking about?
Just a little bit.
Yeah,
I didn't even mean to do that, but I'm, you know.
I know. That's a great segue, actually. Well, like on the completely unintentional, unplanned segue, I'll get actually. Do you want to just explain to everybody listening, you know, who you are, what you do, sure. about the studio?
Mm-hmm. So I founded Agate Studio about a year and a half ago in response to, well, by trade, I am a workplace strategist. And so through the course of my career, I've focused on helping companies design spaces and design programs that help employees do better, like do the best work that's possible. What are the things and spaces that really enable high quality work and therefore create high quality experiences? Through the course of the pandemic, given that the definition of workplace completely got turned on its head and became much more about wherever the people are and whatever resources they need, as opposed to the four walls of an office, I began to feel more and more that I did not fit into the traditional model of what workplace strategy offers. And I wanted to do something that focused more on, you know, getting to those micro and macro trends of really helping an organization go from start to finish through a huge transformation, which has been, it's been needed in many organizations for a long time, but COVID and our experience of working from home, as ramshackle as it was, really was the sort of pressure cooker to say enough is really enough. We're still in this sort of refractory phase where organizations have yet to really have their sort of enlightenment and say, this is what we need to, this is the course we need to go on. And so Agate is really positioned to be a conduit for those big changes. So when organizations and when leaders arrive at that point of mental and emotional readiness, because this is not just a 1, 2, 3, very linear, very easy process to go through. When they reach that point, then I will be there to help them work out really how they center around the work and the people who do the work in ways that 20th century and prior century companies have yet to really suss out.
It's a big deal, really, isn't it? I mean, I think something that you were saying just then, it just kind of occurred to me that I think most of the conversations that like either I had had, and probably actually us going through our own realization, one that I guess at a certain point when the pandemic sort of started that we couldn't, well, not that we couldn't, but we then chose not to work where we were working, which was in a really nice sort of shared office environment that we really love being in and we still have, but that working from home, but maybe a bit easier for us because we'd already been doing that. But the realization of that most of the conversations were that I'd had or heard about people was about, I guess part of it was how hard it was or that they had to do it. And then at some point in that cycle, people go either I like it or I don't like it. And then things like you're talking about, which I actually had, I don't think I'd ever heard the perspective of that it was a long time coming. Like it was, this was, I don't think I really heard that or had that part of a conversation before about this was actually kind of a thing that was a long time coming anyway. So this was like a catalyst for it. Could you just expand on that a bit more? Because like when you were saying it, I was thinking, well, yeah, that's probably because like current workplace, not that everyone works in a factory, but that idea of perhaps, starting in the Industrial Revolution with people working in a workplace in groups in a orderly way, which you obviously see in sort of school too, that culture of that, of breaking the culture is probably like almost more than anything. Maybe that's the long time coming thing.
Totally. Well, I mean, we certainly are in the midst of the fourth industrial revolution, which is really figuring out how to internalize and integrate the world of information that we've established through the internet into the daily practice of work. How does it make things more efficient? How do we just do things better? Because there is all this relatively unimpeachable, even though, the internet is still the internet and there are some quirky little corners of it. There are ways that we can really optimize and become really efficient and effective with how we do work. But most organizations are still very stuck in, there's a lot of the sort of, there are a lot of conversations around neuroplasticity that have come up over the past couple of years about, how deep those habit grooves are in the way that we think and do. Organizations behave the same way. And, it's kind of just like a collective brain that's so stubborn in like, this is the way that we do things. So there are a lot of layers to what you had just said. So first, in terms of it being a long time coming in my experience as a workplace strategist, pretty much since the 2008 financial crisis, and this is very specific to the U.S., even though there were global knock-on effects, a lot of American companies really, really shrunk their real estate portfolios. So the square footage that each desk had got shrunk by like almost 100 square feet. And I'm not good at the meters conversion, so I'm very sorry, listeners. That's a calculation you'll have to do on your own. But it was significantly crunched, moving from cubicles to open desking, which is what a lot of us are very familiar with seeing these days. And some of the results of that were louder environments, not a lot of ease in terms of focus and getting things done, but there was a lot of sort of socializing and sort of the visual cues of I see my coworkers or I see the people who report to me. And so in my mind, I can kind of check the box of I see them and therefore I'm working. So all of these, good or bad, all of them together were creating a bit of a claustrophobic workplace experience. And that was just what budgets were requiring. And that's where the trend was going, partially because we were mimicking what tech companies were doing in the dot-com era and, you know, the after effects of that, thinking, oh, this is what the cool kids are doing. But also the cool kids had no money. And so, you know, there were a couple of question marks. I'm like, it's honestly a little crazy that it went as far as it did because, you know, oh, all these exposed ceilings and this concrete.
Funny. Isn't that funny? It's like a happy accident.
Those were because, you know, these garage band startup companies did not have money to design these spaces. And then the design world was like, that's pretty cool.
That's the problem. That's the problem with designers. Yeah. I'm one. Hello. Hello. That's my problem as well.
But like, isn't it just so funny that, you know, it became cultural and, you know, we wanted that ambiance, but then we didn't necessarily think about how are we going to actually be able to have a conversation? How are we going to be able to actually focus? So we created this aesthetic that looked really cool on paper, but then in practice, everyone hated and still to this day hates. Like you can Google, or, you know, at this point, ChatGPT, a summary of why the open plan workplace is so bad. And it'll tell you, and it'll give you all these answers, and yet we still keep designing them. So I think in my experience, the reason that it's a long time coming is because we were not designing conditions for success in the workplace. So as soon as there was a release valve, even though it came in the shape of a global pandemic, people got to figure out how to work from home and what kind of offerings that gave them. I'm not a proponent of 100% remote or 100% in the office. So we're kind of in this messy middle of how can we still get the benefits of flexibility and comfort of home and focus in, you know, especially in the case of mine where I live by myself, there's no one to distract me other than myself. So there's no kids running around, no animals, no parents, anything like that. So I can really get work done here. So that's like the contemporary, it's been a long time coming. So anyone who's been a workplace strategist through the past 20 years is like, yep, we just needed a huge forcing mechanism and this was it. And then in the larger scale of, you know, from Industrial Revolution to now, it's really fascinating to see how things oscillate in terms of open plan versus enclosure. And we're definitely trending toward more enclosure in the way that things are going to be designed for the next 10, 15 years or so. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we're all on Zoom all the time. And so we need to design environments that are conducive to that and conducive to focus. And collaboration can happen in a lot of different places as long as there's enough space. So there's a lot of really interesting built environment design circumstances and then also just human behavior. You know, we were packing people like sardines and throwing them parties and giving them food and telling them that this is so rad and so exciting because this is what energizing, you know, contemporary company culture is like. And then we had a pandemic where everyone went home and it was like the volume got turned down to zero. And we remembered, oh, wait, this also is not that bad. And now we're trying to figure out how much of that home and comfort are we willing to negotiate? And so far, a lot of companies have yet to really create a good argument for why people should come back to the office and for what reasons.
I think you actually just gave me a framework through talking about that for understanding some of the potential decisions. Like I'm inferring some things here about the space that we also have too, which is like a shared, it's like a, it falls into the cool warehouse kind of space with open plan.
Yep.
But what you were saying actually just gave me a framework maybe for understanding how the person who actually owns that space, some of the design decisions for the changes that have happened in that space that I've seen and just gone, oh yeah, that's they're obviously just like changing things around, and you know, because they've had to, they've actually made I think a couple of extra, or actually no, a few extra individual office spaces that can house like 3 to 4 people over time. Yep. That happened pretty quickly in the early life of it. And we took one of those spaces because, yep. There was a few of us, and also even in the open, in the hot desk sort of areas, they've actually also still, with the exception of a couple of areas, they've mostly still sort of made cool. They look nice and they suit the space, sort of cubicle, either partitions for areas that actually do successfully when I've, ultimately the test is when you actually sit in them for like when you actually sit in them and you're using the space and you've got headphones on, does it feel, does it have the feeling that you didn't have before that happened, you're used to happening, that helps you do certain sorts of work, depending on, what you do too, because sometimes I have to be, there's a whole heap of work where I could probably be around other people and talking and I could still be doing stuff. And then there's other things where I have to have complete isolation. But it was interesting you saying all those points, because I was like, perhaps that was like their realization that, it's just not working. And there's too much hot desking space, which I know happened very early on too, was they went when they opened, which was actually before, that was before COVID. It was like a few years before that anyway. They realized very quickly and they changed this whole section downstairs to be 3 separate offices because they're like, there's too much. And that adaptability and them thinking about it. So like it's given me like a way to understand maybe what they came to realize too.
Yeah, it's a really, it's hard to right now even pin down what the persistent trends are going to be for the next 10 to 15 years. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we're still figuring out how work gets done. So, a lot of companies are jumping to, how do we redesign our space? How do we get people to come back to the office, always focusing on sort of the physical environment? And what really needs to be figured out, which is far less sexy and far less exciting, and that's why people don't want to go in this direction just yet. It's kind of like this is like the last stand. Like you're going to go through all other options before you arrive at, you need to do organizational transformation, because that is like the big, meaty, very complicated work, but it's the work that needs doing in terms of, now that we are permanently going to be in some form of hybrid or dispersed or whatever jargony word you want to use, it changes how the work gets done, because we can't assume that everyone is going to be physically in the same place anymore. And so with these new constraints, how do we get from point A to point B in achieving the work? What are the tools that we need? What digital platforms do we need? What are the ways that we communicate with one another to make sure that nothing gets missed? How do we make sure that we're including the right people, or, not creating any more inequity in the workplace than there already exists? So there are a lot of different lenses that you need to look through in order to create something that is sustainable and effective, but all of that's the work that needs doing. It would kind of be the same as like we're buying a I'm trying to think of like a decent analogy. It's kind of like buying furniture for a house that you haven't even seen yet.
It's actually a lot of the things you're talking about really reminds me, strangely enough, and you might relate to this then too, of app development, of the issues and things that that actually crop up, because we made a lot of apps. We design and develop apps, and they're by and large the most full of potential problems. Even with the best laid plans, it just really reminds me, actually, even looking at your website with the three parts that you have about ideation and, you know, and those tools, like, wow, that's strikingly similar to,
yes,
you know,
I definitely borrow a lot from product development and product mindset, because, well, part of that comes from, I worked at WeWork in the heyday of WeWork, and, you know, the universe could be different in the span of 5 days. So you had to be, we had our forcing mechanism of, we just had to be ready for anything at any given moment. But in general, agile mentality is something that the world of workplace, and even just the world of business, even though they like to say that they're like, you know, big organizations love to say that they're agile, how many meetings before the meeting do you have? And there's not a lot of, like, gather and scrum and then disperse. There isn't a lot of that kind of mechanism in how most organizations work. And in honesty, it's a blocker for them in terms of, there are so many possibilities in terms of what could be developed or how a company could operate if the metaphorical leash was let out a little longer than it currently is. And there's a lot of I think, what's the right way to say this? Leadership has been conditioned to focus on that line of sight management style. So kind of what I mentioned before, of if you see, when you're in a workplace, especially like an open plan that makes it very easy, you can lock eyes or just lock in where your team is. And by visual, you kind of assume that they're working. When we are all behind screens in different locations, sitting at home, some probably sitting on a beach or, you know, wherever it might be, there is this unchecked worry or anxiety that work isn't getting done because you aren't seen. And there's a lot of, you know, to be a genuine leader today into the future, you need to have a lot of certainty around how you manage people who are not right in front of you. And that's not necessarily a leadership skill that is well honed. And so that, you know, that's really what we're seeing, is that managers and executives don't know how to, they don't know how to pivot, or they don't know how to iterate themselves into, the conditions are different, what's required of me is different, and here's how I will evolve. That a lot of people are lacking that bridge. And rather than figuring out how to build the bridge, the instinct and sort of the knee-jerk reaction is, well, let's see if we can get everyone to go back to what we had in 2019. We'll try that first. And we're going to try really hard at that first.
It's so funny. Like, it's not really ha-ha funny, but it's you know, that sort of irony.
It's bleak funny.
It is bleak funny, which I do. I'm sorry to say to everyone listening, I do like bleak funny. I find it very funny.
Although not New Yorker, so that's kind of how we live.
Yeah, not when it happens to me, though. I find it very unfunny. I feel sad then. But, I think that's, I guess, in one respect, it's like a natural response, like to try to return to what you had before and see if that works. And it's like, well, it worked before, so, you know, it's probably going to work again. We just have to force everyone to do it after they're like really happy working in their jammies at home, you know.
Yeah.
And people, you know, I mean, like, why, for like a lot of people who are like, well, you know, this is great. I get to be paid. Some, you know, I don't have to spend petrol going to work. I don't have to, like, fight that morning rush. I don't have to then, like, rush around and grab my kids because they're just down the road at school now. And then I can go at any point and do that. I mean, there's any number of reasons, yeah. But then
and the spectrum goes from, like, you know, very scrub, you're in your pajamas, not actually engaged, to like the very practical, you know, parents get to be blocks or minutes away from their kids as opposed to hours, you know, especially in a city like New York. The majority of people who work in New York City are people who are commuting from Connecticut, from Long Island, from up from Westchester, or even further up in New York State and New Jersey, even like Philadelphia and the Pennsylvania area. So there are people that are commuting really, really long distances, which means that they are so far removed from the day to day of their family life. And so there's a lot of there actually was a really interesting Wall Street Journal article that came out recently. And it was honestly a little surprising that it came from the Journal, saying that, or just using Washington, D.C. as an example. Downtown D.C., where all the office buildings are, is pretty, not necessarily desolate, but not active. But in more residential neighborhoods like Georgetown or Foggy Bottom and a couple of other neighborhoods in that area, they're thriving because people are, you know, people are going out to lunch on their lunch hour. They're stopping by the coffee shop while they're walking their dog, or, you know, picking up or dropping off their kids. So there's like, what I love about where I am positioned is I get to know all this nitty gritty about the workplace and what goes into designing workplace. Mm. But then on the other side of the coin, which, you know, for me, I think, has a lot more emotional meaning, is what is the future of cities and how can we reevaluate how physical spaces get reallocated to things that are more measurably meaningful.
Is there, like, say with what you've been doing, how much do you work with, or do you work with, or have discussions with people like architects and urban planners and those sorts of people, because we
not so much urban planners, but definitely architects. I'm very connected in like the landlord space, just because I've been in and around the real estate world my entire career. Mm. It is interesting to see the evolution of that side of the industry's thinking around things, because there is a lot of disjointedness around how companies think about space for their people. Like, you know, how Amazon would think about workplace for their people, or Adobe would think about space for their people, as opposed to how a landlord who owns these assets in central business districts is thinking about things. So it's been a very push-pull conversation for the past 3 years. But, you know, it's at least in cities in the US, like San Francisco is probably San Francisco is going through a rough time in certain ways, because there's just been so much flight from that city. Mm. So much of the tech community has left that area, either to go back to Silicon Valley. A lot have moved to, like, a lot of companies have repositioned to Texas and Austin. Some have gone to Los Angeles. So
I've heard about that, especially with Texas too. I've heard that really just by sort of osmosis, I suppose, like hearing people talking about it on podcasts and people saying this and that. And then I found that really curious, but whilst I don't know a lot about the precise details, I sort of have a general understanding of why, with a combination of work, family, friends, something new, having just even that simple idea of having a change, I think is kind of almost a little bit underrated.
The power. And taxes. The lack of taxes is a big thing.
Sure, yeah. But it's also like you don't know what you don't know. Like, even if somebody mentioned it a few years before and say, hey, it's really great, there's no taxes here, you're still, you know, holed up in the place where your business is, where your family is, where all your work or you think all your work comes from, and then all of a sudden there's a reason, or there's like a catalyst to make a change, which for many people was was then something like COVID, and they were like, well, you know, I always wanted to, and I feel a little bit braver because all my friends are doing it, and I've heard it could be good.
So I mean, that's the thing that's been so funny about New York. You know, the New York at the beginning of the pandemic definitely got battered with COVID, and residents. New York was really one of the roughest places in the U.S. in 2020 COVID-wise. And so there was a lot of coverage of, oh, New York is dead. New York is dead. And it's not. It, like, the number of people that the influx of people, I think, outnumbered the output of people who went to suburbs or different cities and all that kind of stuff. So that attitude of just like, it's now, you know, I survived a global pandemic. I may as well do the thing that I've always kind of been wondering if I'll do.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I think that's those core probably too far to go as to say they're primal sort of like drivers for people, but it's still, they're very emotional things though too.
Oh, yeah. If you've got an itch for something.
No, you've always wanted to do it. I mean, I think I had this conversation with someone, I mean, over your way too recently about real estate and like the big drive to move to the country and or not necessarily moving to live in the country, but to have somewhere in the country for, you know, any number of reasons, just in case the world ends, or because they like it, or because, you know, or because they came from the country originally. And but like that's then driven, you know, this other aspect of real estate. Yeah. So it's closed down. There's a perceived so I think you were sort of touching on a little bit before this, there's a perceived idea of which is still rooted in reality about things that happen as a result of a pandemic that are bad, and then everyone focuses on that, but they then don't focus on these other opportunities that arise, of which are, you know, and they're not in the media, you know, they're not being talked about, but they're there.
And it's also early, you know, like apparently the sewage water in New York City is saying that COVID's back. So, you know, jury's out on that one. But what I mean more is like, it's still so early. We're still kind of in, you know, just like companies are still in the refractory period of like, they don't necessarily want to address the big meaty problems yet because they're hoping the smaller problems will solve the big problem, or addressing the smaller problems will mitigate the big problem. And I think people are still kind of coming out of their shells in terms of, you know, we're still shedding our COVID selves, how we, you know, the selves that needed to survive, you know, isolation and just an extra level of threat and you know, fear and those kinds of things. So I feel like we're going to hit a stride in the, from a, like a societal perspective in the next, you know, year or so, and then we'll start to really see some interesting stuff. But you're right. You know, if you think about, what was it? The 1918 pandemic, you know, the Roaring Twenties came after that. And after the plagues in Europe in the Middle Ages, the Renaissance came after that. So, you know, it sounds a little like, I don't know, maybe we'll see. But at the same time,
yeah, I think there's a big
history does repeat itself when those extreme things happen. There is always a really big and loud cultural response in some way or another. So,
Yeah, I mean, people want to get back. Yeah, people want to get. I think there's sort of almost two paths. People want to get back into it, and they're sick and tired of not having their lives as they used to be. And then also, I think there's like a practical part where, through, you know, either for whatever happens in situations like that, with either people passing away, businesses going out of business, there's all these other opportunities all of a sudden come out of the woodwork for other people that were somewhere further down the rung in that industry, or whatever way you want to say it, where they then all of a sudden are able to blossom, you know, like a beautiful butterfly, and and like spread their wings, and you know, and then they have an opportunity or opportunities that they didn't previously have because of whatever reason. So I mean, that's both good and bad for different groups of people, but they are, it is what it is, I guess. Like, I think that's very true. Like, it's like the, you know, if you want to get philosophical about it, which you might, Corinne, you might want to get philosophical.
Yes. As a religious philosophy major. Yeah, I just might. Existentialism. Yeah. I know all about it.
Yeah. Why not? Go ahead. You know, but like, it's like the flowing, you know, it's like when water, you know, will find its own path, you know, in anywhere you put water, you know. I remember sort of years ago when we were building this house, and the pitch of our roof was like really, really low, and we had all this rain and the water, and we kept on having these water dripping way inside the house, and we couldn't find this hole in the roof. And I was really puzzled by it. And until one day, like, the builder was like, he sort of said almost those words. He said, like, water will just find its way to wherever it wants to track. So it would track, because the pitch was so low, it would track down the gutter and track underneath and stick to the underneath of the roof and would track up underneath. It was too low a pitch, actually. It was not legal pitch. It was like a previous builder, but it would track up inside the house. And I always remember that, because I was like, that's such a great metaphor for a range of things. The things will just find their way to wherever wherever they want to go.
Think about the Grand Canyon. Like, all of that erosion happened just from the river. Well, not necessarily. Like, there was also like a fault, but anyway. All of this creativity that got pent up, and all this creativity, all of this momentum that we didn't necessarily know where to place it during the pandemic. And also, we had all this time to really reevaluate where we were putting that energy prior to the pandemic, and whether it's where we still wanted to invest that and invest it thereafter. So we're definitely still in this phase of shedding and reevaluation and figuring out what still fits us and what doesn't. And it's, you know, bringing it back to a company and a workplace, it's hard to predict what's needed when, you know, the dial for entropy is like turned up to max. We are just not in a period of certainty, and that is something that is fundamentally scary for businesses. That is why I use as much product development thinking as I do, because when you come up with those kinds of systems and frameworks, it allows you to be more okay with that entropy, because you're not trying to solve for everything. You're just trying to solve for the constants. And then the other variables just stay, you know, they stay as is, or they surprise you, but you still have enough resiliency built in.
That's another core thing, isn't it? Is it maybe also I guess a part of that, not, you know, how much a part of it, I'm not sure, but emotional intelligence about being, you know, kind of being able to handle particular situations, like you were saying, like at the end of the day, like someone who's running a business, they're just another person who've got their own series of, you know, things going on, and then they have to manage this like dramatic sort of change in what they thought their business was, and how okay are they to do that, and then how resilient and how, you know, because the term emotional intelligence seems to be like used a lot in recent times. You didn't really seem to hear it that much. Actually, as far as I really remember, if I try to like think back to maybe even like 5 or 6 years ago, you didn't.
I think it was a 2018 thing.
Yeah.
But I couldn't remember because that was those are my WeWork years. So I didn't know if that was a WeWork woo woo thing, which it very well could have been. but no, it was around 2018 that it became a thing to talk about, and then it turned into empathy, and that's where we are now.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, there's always the risk with any catchphrase of it being losing its real meaning. You know, if it's used too much, when people are like, "Oh, emotional intelligence," and they don't really, even know what it means. But I mean, I think generally people understand it, but where that then fits into what you're talking about, I find really interesting because it's almost like part of the answer is far more simple than people realize, like not simple to do, but like to go, okay, well, if we're all like more emotionally intelligent and, you know, just better at dealing with sort of change and, you know, more resilient, once again, like, easy to say, it's not just like, hey, everyone just become more resilient overnight.
Yeah. Resilient and it's going to be fine.
Just take a resilience pill and you'll be cool. You know, and it's like, I wonder what color it would be. Would it be purple or?
I don't know. I was going with orange in my mind.
Yeah, maybe orange is better. Yeah. Purple would be like the wealth pill. You know, it'd be, But I think you're right. Orange. Definitely. Yeah, that's the resilience. That's the but so when you start working with somebody with a organization, where does your role begin and end? I'm sure that's different for different people, but you know, give us like a case study.
Yeah, so in general, I tend to be at the top of the funnels, so to speak, in terms of internal problems that a company is facing. So there's a company that I've been working with that they already have a hybrid plan set up. And they did this work a couple of years ago. It's worked pretty well. And now they're looking to move on to version 2 and do the updates, get the qualitative research to really record and integrate the learnings from these couple of years into this version 2. So I get called in to basically do discovery. So I'm the one who would be leading all of those research exercises to really evaluate what is, you know, what's working or what was the initial plan, and then actually going out into the field, talking to teams, talking to people and saying, this is what's written. How is it actually working in practice? Do these principles that have been mapped out actually make sense in reality? Is anything missing? Are there unwritten norms within the company that prevent certain principles from actually happening? So it's all just effectively doing an audit. What's actually working and what isn't, what's missing, and presenting that back to clients and saying, this is what I've learned. You've hired me because you trust my analysis. Now here are some recommendations of how we can move forward in terms of making updates to this program, and then start to go through what is the kit of parts that an employee needs access to actually live up to what this plan is saying that it wants to. So beyond the basic kit of a laptop, you know, Zoom, email, all those basics, what are the other things that are making sure that knowledge transfer is happening successfully? Basically all of these things that are typically unwritten. You know, when we think about culture, culture is a lot of unwritten stuff that we just all kind of absorb and learn as we go. And as we you know, as companies move into this post-COVID world, the things that have been implicit, the sort of things we pick up on, or, you know, someone informs us that's passé or that's a faux pas, you need to be doing this, all of that stuff needs to be documented, because that is the one thing that having a dispersed company loses, is that, you know, everyone can kind of, I don't want to use the word conform, but can get used to, or can get an understanding of how things are done within
on the same page.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. That's much better. That's much better. Conformity is boring. But so really running them through this gamut of, you've come to me with a problem, I'm going to assess what you think the problem is and either verify or tell you what the actual problem might be, then give you this map of, here's how we might be able to approach resolution, or, you know, supplement to what the problem, to how the problem can get solved, build, you know, from a more sort of, I live in the world of decks, which is mind-blowingly boring, but things need to be written down and documented. But it's really about, my whole mission is getting decision makers and operators on the same page or on a different page about how things might be able to get done, and have a broader mindset around how things can be interpreted, not just for their own sake, but because the people who they are providing these things for invariably are going to have different perceptions than they do. And they need to be able to be responsive, and responsive rather than reactive to things that happen. Because just like, you know, to revert back to the product development model we've been talking about, there are always going to be bugs. There are always going to be things that crash. That's just the nature of the thing. When there's too many users, things break. So rather than that being a huge crisis, having those kind of hiccups built into the process, built into, okay, well, when those kinds of things happen, this is how we circumvent, and this is how we internalize the knowledge of how we might be able to avoid it in the future. So build the system, or these programs get stronger over time, because the inputs from the users make the model stronger. And so that's my mission, is company culture can't just be all these high flying words that, you know, people say and platitudes. They need to be brought down into how a company actually operates. And a lot of it, right, when people talk about workplace and culture, a lot of it is geared towards that built environment, rather than what's the shared language between people? What is the shared language between teams? How is information shared? How are people treated? All, you know, all of these very crucial things. That's the sort of very amorphous chameleon-like space that I live in. And so projects can really take on a different, they can take on a different face very quickly. Because we might go in to fix a built environment problem when actually the problem might be a leadership problem. And so a lot of these things, because the next, it's all centered around work getting done. And that's the sort of, the vacuum that brings all of these things together.
Yeah. Is there, well, actually, I probably know the answer to this, but I'll ask it anyway. I'll actually ask it in a slightly different way. Do you? I'm sure you'd probably come across, when you're going through this process, reluctance on it, with, say, you know, employees or people doing the work, sometimes to provide information for, you know, either fear of, you know, people upstairs realizing certain things, or the other way around, like people who are who think there's a certain issue, then finding it hard to accept the reality too. Yeah, I'm sure that's. I would almost hazard to say that's almost like the norm, is it? Or is it?
Yes. And that's been something that I've needed to hone as I've gone further in my career of it's very interesting to see how the work that I do it's really just people and how willing or how capable people are to really look straight at the root cause of problems.
Mm.
And the population of folks who are really comfortable with sitting with inconvenient or ugly truths are a very small community. Mm. And when you come across someone as a client who you know can handle it, then like that's a dream come true, because then that means you can really dig into things that other clients or just other people in general don't have the capacity for. And it's a really interesting thing to, you know, as I grow up as a person and I, you know, do the work for myself in terms of self-development and just, you know, being nicer to myself and all these things that you need to learn. And when you go to therapy, it is really remarkable how transferable that kind of understanding and empathy translates to work and work relationships, because it doesn't matter if you're right. It really does not matter how right you are. It matters how ready and how willing the person on the other side of the table is to hear whatever you've got to say.
Yeah, being a good listener. It's super important, isn't it? It really is. I mean, it's just so those sorts of skills like seem to underpin everything. I mean, at the end of the day, it's still whatever you're doing to help somebody improve their workplace with all the things you've been talking about. It's still all just human relationships, as people talking with people. It's like when I sort of have to remind myself too, because I fall into the trap of somebody reacts a certain way as a client. It's like, I don't know what's happening in their life. Like, they just had a really bad day, you know, and they're not reacting because of anything really that I said. They're reacting disproportionately. Mm-hmm. And to remind yourself just to not take that like first initial reactive leap is just to take that little pause is, you know, I still have to remind myself to do that too, because I know that, I mean, because everyone goes through things and you make assumptions like all the time, like we all do. You always make assumptions about this person is going to be like this just because of, you know, based on whatever, you know, there's all sorts of different factors.
Yeah. Well, and it also depends on what people are motivated by. And I think that's been one of the most interesting things for me. I've always been this way of like, this is broken, we should fix it. And there are a lot of people, especially, I would say companies require this of the people who work for them, even if these people are actually like in their own lives behave differently. Companies don't actually want that much change. They want to keep the status quo and they want to keep things stable and static because that is what's safe and healthy for their business. It's what's safe and healthy for their shareholders, all that kind of stuff. So someone like me that is constantly pointing out, that's not as good as it could be. We should really work on that. Like, that is a lot of ruffle and a lot of mess that most companies are not willing to get into. And so that can often supersede how people behave. And if anything, it can dampen how people behave, because risk aversion is actually something that companies rely on from their employees, because they want to keep things stable.
So understandably, I mean, it's understandable, isn't it?
In 100%. Still think they're wrong, but like I said, they're not ready to look in that mirror.
Yeah. Sounds like you definitely have your work cut out for you, Corinne. Like I wouldn't like I've worked actually like heaps of times over the years with say with like HR consultants or people who are doing business transformation, and we've worked from the brand side of things, like developing like a brand for somebody. And I always like, I'm always like, I'm glad that's not my job. That sounds like I was like, I'd take my hat off to you, honestly, because it sounds like a rough ride, you know, to be able to, there'd be like a lot of, but also interesting, like, cause there's a part of that, cause I always sort of like a good challenge in things too. So to me, that sounds like a really interesting sort of nut to crack, you know, to be able to get like through, you know, through the outer shell and be like, yeah, like get down to the nitty gritty of like,
totally.
And to have other people, I guess like it's what I would imagine. And so the maybe you can then speak to this is, I would imagine it would almost be most rewarding. I guess I'm relating this to things that I've done too with people, like from a design point of view, is seeing people come to their own realization and go, and that you've like, you haven't, you've provided information and you've provided, you know, any great amount of like data and like feedback and no amount of, say, persuasion or coercion is going to make them like do it. It's just not going to ever happen,
right?
And like in a million years, but them through your sort of guidance and through your kind of like helping them going, like actually just coming to like a little aha moment or realization and go, yeah, actually that's, because they kind of, people have to do that anyway. They gotta realize it themselves for it to really sink
absolutely.
In.
Absolutely. And because of the work that I do, it requires people to recognize that change is necessary. When change is kind of like a side order at dinner, that is not where my work or the things that I would want to do for a client is most useful. When they are at a point where change is the only option, I'm your lady. Like, I'm ready to get in there and roll up my sleeves and do the hard work with you. And it is meaty, messy, challenging work, but to me, it is tied so centrally to how we are as people, whether we're working or not. And I think, you know, coming out of the pandemic and even coming out of my experience at WeWork, especially in the US, we have a remarkably unhealthy relationship to work. And if what I can do can put any dent in making the relationship between work and life any more bearable, any more easy, then that's like, I'm good with that. And so my goal is really to help companies approach change from a position of, what can we do? What's the low hanging fruit that's not going to upset everything? Because I think there a lot of companies and a lot of people see change in very binary ways of status. Like we're in stasis or we're in times of tumult. And what I want is to help people, help companies approach change from, there are some gigantic changes that are needed, but what are the lower stakes changes we can make that might let us delay the big changes a little bit more, or we might find ways that we can completely circumvent those big changes because we're doing little changes. So
that's the flow on effect from them, perhaps.
Exactly. And so that's really my mission, is like, how can we downgrade the perceived risk of change? So that way experimentation and testing in things that are still isolated from the core ways that a company operates, what are the things that are kind of up for play or up for grabs? And just letting, that's really what I mean when I say companies letting the leash out a little bit more. You know, there are a lot of levers that can be played with that can really transform how people work, where people work, the resources they have access to, that won't harm or won't do anything to how a company operates from like a bottom line perspective. And so that's really what I'm after, is how can we do that? Because to me, that is a net benefit to, like, not just employees, but the orbit of the people that are in those employees' lives, and then the influence that it'll have, you know, that's a little on the idealist side, but like, that's the dent I want to make.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a very pragmatic and also just really sensible sort of way to go about it, to like an easy in for, especially something that, whether it's going to be some big change or whether it's not, the perception about it being a bigger change than it's going to be is, could imagine, be very fearful for people. So having like a little bite of the cherry and then also being able to see that, you know, action and be done would be like, that's, you know, that would be very rewarding. And then it's an easier way to do it instead of, you know, I guess that's linked very strongly to people putting things off too. Like I'm terrible with certain sort of tasks of putting them off. And, you know, like, heaps of people are like, I'm great at getting like into other things, and then, you know, other stuff like you put off. And then when you look back on it, you go, actually, there's no real, it was kind of silly because there was real.
Why did I put that off for 3 months?
Yeah. It didn't make any sense at all. Like it was just the perception of what that represented, but it was taking away time from point A or sort of whatever. But I'm saying when you're, talking with people about their values and their brand values, how many different companies or different entities that you work with have actually take what, say, some, you know, agency or whatever, I think you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah, like, I do. But
that, how many actually take that and actually use it, like actually implement it in
very few.
Say it again.
Very, very few. Well, I think so. It's actually funny. A company that I advise, I ran them through this, their initial mission, purpose, values exercise close to a year ago. They're a climate tech company for the real estate world. And so we figured out what their mission was, what their purpose, and we figured out the words that really resonated for their values. And then the next leg was, okay, what does that look like in practice? What are the operating principles that are built out of these values? And I think, and even that, you know, we will go back and reevaluate those and say, okay, great. We said this in summer of 2022. How realistic, like how real were they through this year? What needs changing? What, you know, what did we miss, or what is relevant now that wasn't relevant today? Companies just don't do that. They throw around these words like weapons of like, you're not being authentic, or like, you're not being an entrepreneur, but then they don't actually demonstrate pathways for their people to actually live up to those values. So there's this gap between all this really great hard work that brand strategists do but then it kind of gets cut short at like, wow, that's so nice and it's so pretty. But then they don't, there isn't this, there are two things that tend to be missing, at least in my experience. One is what we mean when we say these things and what it looks like in practice. How, like, how are you, you know, if tenacious is one of your brand values, how does that show up in a day-to-day practice? Are you shushing someone who is trying to stand up for what they think is actually right? And if so, you know, that person is demonstrating tenacity. But what's the context? Is that just the unilateral, you say no to things, or is it a particular reason? So that to me is where I feel like companies fall short on leveraging the values that they spend a ton of money and effort to create. You know,
absolutely,
it's this beautiful package that has so much meaning. And yet they kind of just leave it. They're like, oh, that's nice. We're going to just put it up on that top shelf over there. And, you know, we'll refer back to it when we've got a big company meeting.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, and the reason why I guess I asked that was to hear you say what I already knew, but
happy to do it.
Not that I knew you were going to do that or anything, Corinne, because why would I know that? I've only just met you, you know, so, but, is that it's always struck me as kind of curious because I've worked like lots of times over the years with, say, like business consultants or business coaches, sometimes just as our clients, but sometimes then, and, you know, people similar to yourself too, who, you know, who like either in a HR role or sort of, you know, somewhere between like a CFO and a business consultant, all the different multifaceted configurations of people that work with businesses. But the things that, but what I've always found curious is to any time that I've had an opportunity, and it's been more of a happy accident than anything, where we've been working as like, you know, for somebody's brand, and we've also known and been working closely with the business coach or the business consultant in that business, it's always been fantastic. It's always been this really fantastic, like nice, smooth, like pretty good result. And it's always struck me as really odd that that doesn't happen as the norm, because that's, to me, that makes most sense, and that makes the most likelihood that, you know, things that are brand values or, you know, any work that you do from like a philosophical then design side is going to be, have at least a higher probability. It's no guarantee it's going to then just be like, you know, used, like you were saying, but there's going to be a higher probability because it's come from both like two touch points and probably from a touch point where they probably value the, they probably trust more like, say, a business consultant or coach than, you know, than us. They probably, and they might trust us also, but it's a different sort of relationship. They're talking about money. They're talking about their future.
It's definitely a different relationship. So a couple things. One, I think the reason that like there is the anchor of, we are all strategists. And even if we are different, we're strategists with different contexts. We all speak the same sort of core language of how we approach problems, how we synthesize, all those kinds of things. So, because I've found the same thing too. And a couple of friends who are brand strategists, we've basically come to the conclusion that brand strategists build brands for the outer world. They're taking the story of a company and projecting it out into the world. Whereas someone like me, who is a little bit of a jack of all trades, but more just internally facing strategist, I go into the company. We are basically back to back. So you are telling the story of a company out into the world, whereas we are telling the story of the company either to its leaders or to its people. So we're all like, we are very similar in that regard. And so, yeah, if you stick a bunch of strategists in a room, like you're going to get a lot of really, really great ideas, and no chance of how to implement them.
Yeah. It's
God bless our project managers.
Yeah. And it always seems like such, you know, from that very high level, you go, wow, it's so simple. It'd be really easy if everyone just worked together and, you know, and everyone had like a unified approach. Easier said than done, but still it doesn't mean that it's not a worthy thing to try to do. You know, it doesn't make it any less kind of worthy still to try it, because any time that it's happened almost accidentally, it hasn't been a part of, okay, we're going to work together jointly with this client. It has just happened like that, usually because of an introduction and them going, you guys, like, your brand's terrible, you need some help, you know, or sort of whatever, or as simple as it needs to be tweaked a little bit. It just needs a brand refresh. But it's always been really good. I've found in my experience anyway. But but say, like, as we're getting, I guess, towards the end of the podcast, like, in what's one of the things that in your current experience that you, I guess, get the most value out of? I'm just talking from, say, your point of view, from maybe even results that you get for people. Like, for you personally, what are some of the greatest or the nicest things or whatever that you get out of what you do, for people and for companies?
I have a very strong sort of high tides raise all ships mentality. So to me, I think it's very keyed into this moment, because I think the pressure is still building around that necessary change I've been talking about. And so where I get a lot of gratification is talking with people and, you know, not to say that I'm, you know, number one, but like getting people to think outside of the box around problems, getting them to think about the possibilities of, I hadn't thought about it that way, or, oh yeah, this problem is like the problem that I'm looking at the symptoms. I'm not actually looking at the problems. And so helping people to get better at analysis and getting down to the root of things is really gratifying for me, because we need more people who are able to think and identify those things. Because, you know, years ago, I remember talking with a dear friend of mine, and we both kind of identified as a little bit of misfit toys. We kind of knew too much for our own good, and we're getting ourselves in trouble as a result. And this is when we were in our 20s. So, you know, it was really, we were punching above our weight without the credentials. And I remember us joking around and saying, like, we were kind of like Don Quixote, like we were just yelling that the windmills were alive and all this kind of stuff. And no one was ready to believe us. And that's funny, but it is also not productive. And so being able to use what I am good at to help other people build these skills, because this is not the mission for one person. This is a collective, this needs to be a collective movement and a collective analysis of what's working and what isn't. So I get a lot of gratification out of seeing more and more people not jump at the headlines or not look at, you know, not be, you know, look beyond the snacks and the parties and all these things that companies tend to throw at their employees as, you know, oh, we have such good culture. Getting people to say, that's we need to look behind that stuff. What, you know, what's the real substance to those things? So, I get a lot of validation out of helping other people look beyond the veneer.
Yeah. It almost sounds like, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but sort of helping helping people to find that meaning, you know, that they might need, that they don't realize that that is even there. I mean, I'm honestly a big believer that whatever that meaning is, like for you, like just in your life, or the meaning that you might be, you know, trying to open up that door so people can sort of see it, like it's so undervalued. And and I find it, I mean, it ties a little bit for me into seeing sort of a cultural shift with things like podcasts, even say what we're doing, or you see like long form content, which if you take it to traditional internet sort of media, they're generally have been in the past always saying, you know, how things need to be like short, snappy, because people have very short attention spans. And I just don't buy it. And it's proven, I mean, yeah, they do, because they watch it because that's what they're fed. But people also are very willing, in fact, like, and it shows like extremely willing to like find different sorts of meaning in things that are the complete polar opposite of that. And like actually listen for, you know, a couple of hours to two people talking about a subject. Because and that to me like says a lot about, you know, this sort of untapped potential that everybody just has there, I think, naturally.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's this element too of people tend to go for like the confetti kind of things, the things that are going to give you the metaphorical sugar high, rather the things that are really substantial. So the things that make you slow down, or the things that really you get to just sort of
smell.
Just like be languid and hang out with. There's this, without it being about ego, knowing, giving people what they need versus what they want.
And sometimes
being willing to be told that your assumptions are wrong always, but with all of your homework and all the research and all the things that you, all the experiences you've done, you know what is more substantial. And how do we guide people to that in a way that it's not domineering and controlling?
I never forget this like Chinese proverb. I'm terrible at it, but it sort of goes along the lines of it was like something that when I was doing martial arts, my instructor sort of told me about being a good instructor, which was about that like the best. There were three different sorts of instructors, but like the best level of that was that, you know, you don't show people like how to walk through the door, that you show them the door, but they have to walk through it. But you actually show them the door, but you're not telling them how to do it. They have to work that out for themselves, but you're there to guide them to, to do that in the best possible way. And that's always sort of stayed with me, like, because it seems to be just one of those truths, you know?
Yeah. It's one of those universal truths that, until you do it yourself, you don't necessarily know how true it is. That's a truth.
You have to do it. Yeah. So have you got, just as at the now, sadly, Corinne, at the end of our podcast, could I ask you to provide or tell everyone like a quote that you might like to be from you, even or from one that you feel sort of unrelates to what we've been talking about, or not even that, just something that you like.
Sure. Yeah. One that I always fall back to is a quote from Arthur Ashe, who was a famous tennis player One of the U.S. Open stadiums here in New York is named for him. The quote is, start where you are, use what you have, and do what you can. And that is a very, for me, that is a very central mantra.
That's great. Yeah. I like that. I've never heard that one before. That's wonderful. I like that.
A good one.
Yeah.
Very, very practical, but also, for me, motivating.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So, could you also tell everyone, just in wrapping up, the best way to get in contact with you?
Sure.
Like how do they find out more about you online? We'll provide a link also in the on the podcast too. But
awesome. Yeah. So my website is agate.studio. So agate.studio. And LinkedIn, Corinne Murray. I think I've got a blue sweater on. And you'll see that Arthur Ashe quote in my little background tile. And then Twitter, even though I don't really post on there, I just look at all the kooky things that people say. So that's Corinne or underscore Corinne Murray underscore is my Twitter.
Yeah. I think I use LinkedIn for the same way. Yeah. Yeah. I usually just like things and hardly ever comment.
Yeah.
No, that's but actually, just one very last question. I'm curious, what was the original inspiration for the name of Agate? I mean, I've got my own idea for why you may have chosen it, but
So let's see. I had just gotten back from a trip to Joshua Tree, which is one of the national parks here in the U.S., which is absolutely stunning. And it's a very special place. I'd been there once before by myself. And so very special place for me. I froze. Hang on. Oh, there you are.
Yeah.
Sorry, froze. So I just gotten back from Joshua Tree. That's a very special place for me. And I needed to just figure out what my company name was. And I couldn't think of anything that I felt good about. I didn't want it to be like a very techie name where it's just like all, you know, consonants with no vowels and things like that. And so the person I had gone with, we had gotten like a bunch of like crystals and all that kind of stuff, as you do when you go to a national park, I feel like. And one of the ones that I had gotten was an agate stone. And I happened to just kind of gravitate towards getting that one. I have a few here at home. And I looked up what the spiritual meaning of it was. And agate represents the calming of anxiety during transformations and changes. So that felt very on brand for literally for what I was trying to do. And then from the less woo-woo side of the spectrum, because not everyone's going to think that that's a cool or legitimate reason to call your company that.
Yeah.
The way that agate stones are actually formed is within air pockets of I think lava. And so agate is a stone where there's a lot of layers, kind of like how if you were to slice a tree, all the rings inside. So each of those different rings represents different sediment from different eras. And so the stone is created over millennia, and all these different striations and colorations come from just the circumstances of different times. And so I really liked the spiritual definition of it. And then also just something is created year over year, era over era, to come into something that is complete. And I just really liked both of those reasons.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, that's I didn't know any of that. And but just looking visually at what you've got on your website too, the first thing that popped into my head was just layers, you know, different layers of business, like that sort of the different, which is also once again like a really universal metaphor to apply. But that's exactly. it's a great way to end the podcast. Have you got anything else you'd like to share with everyone before we go, Corinne?
I don't. This has been a lot of fun though. Thank you.
How about like have a great day?
Have a great day, everyone.
Ha ha.
Listen to the Jesse Ware album if you haven't listened to it yet. It's a really good time.
That's funny. Okay. So with that in mind, that's actually it for today, everyone. Thanks so much for listening into our podcast. And thank you, Corinne. Thank you yet again.
Thank you so much. This is such a treat.
Yeah, no, it's been great. Before we go, please leave your feedback as well as any suggestions for any topics you would like us to discuss in future episodes. Thanks again for listening to the Grey Business Podcast, and we'll see you again soon. Bye, guys.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Grow Your Business. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time here at the Grow Your Business Podcast.